This is Ron Orrell, and you're listening to the Activist Invest in Today podcast. And I'm super excited that I once again have on the podcast Keith Gottfried, who leads Gottfried Shareholder Advisory, which is a firm that advises companies on how to plan for the day they could be targeted by an activist. And he also advises companies currently facing shareholder insurgencies. So thanks, Keith, for taking the time.
Ron, very pleased to join you today and always delighted to speak with you about shareholder activism.
Okay, yes. I love our conversations about the topic, and I have a bunch of different things I want to get through today. So let's get started. So lately, I'm spending a lot of time going through activist settlements, and I got some data from DealPoint Data where that there were 38 settlements so far in the U.S. in 2024. And there were 74 and 75 in all of 2023 and 2022, respectively. So it seems like we might be a little bit behind in total settlements. But I also have some data to suggest that we're seeing an uptick in recent years of activist settlements setting up board strategic review committees. And so basically, the activist and the company agree to set up a committee that will look into strategic options. A lot of times these committees are called operational capital allocation and strategic review committee, I guess trying to reduce expectations there. But they set up these strategic review committees, the activists and their outside candidates, and sometimes the activists' own portfolio managers are getting on these committees. And I think they often are like 4 members, 5 members. So definitely a subset of the overall board. And I guess I just want to get your thoughts on these committees from a 50,000 foot level, Keith. Why are activists wanting to set up these committees, and what powers do they want them to have? And I guess, what are companies willing to give up to set up these panels?
So, Ron, these types of arrangements have been around for quite a while. They're not new. This is something you saw taking place pre-pandemic. Mm-hmm. And the idea here is that the activist wants to see the company sold, wants to see the company start a sales process, does not trust the company on its own to run that process, wants to be very much involved in that sales process. And here's the kicker, wants that process to be done in a way that kind of have my cake and eat it too. So the activist wants to participate in the process, but then they don't want to be restricted in being able to trade later on. They want that whole process at some point, significant aspects of that process brought into the public realm and publicly disclosed so that they are cleansed. And you'll see specific provisions that use that term cleanse, that the company needs to cleanse the activist at some point in the process.
Mm-hmm. And so are we typically seeing the activists seek to get their own people on these committees, or at least to have external candidates that they've nominated or urging the company to put on these committees? How important is it for the activists to get these people on these committees? And when a company basically agrees to set up this kind of committee, what kind of things should they be wary of? I've seen a few of these where the panels get to hire their own bankers, they get to hire their own legal advisors. It seems like the activist wants to minimize the influence of the rest of the board and really have this committee play a very important role. Is that your assessment?
Yeah. So I've been involved in situations where the activist completely owned the committee and it was the new directors put on the board by the activist that dominated the committee, and the committee had its ability, had the ability to hire its own counsel and own banking firm. Mm-hmm. Now, in larger, very sophisticated companies, the approach I've also seen is where the activists, let's say they add 2 directors to the board or 3, mm-hmm. 2 directors are going to go and it's going to be a committee of 4 people mm-hmm. and the company will want to have 50% membership. Mm-hmm. The company will want to have at least one of their guys or gals be a co-chair. And then the company needs to be very thoughtful about the charter. Mm-hmm. For the committee, and the activist is going to specifically provide in the cooperation agreement, the settlement agreement, that they have to agree to the charter and no amendments can be made without their person's representatives agreeing to it. But the company needs to be very careful about the composition and that it does have some, if not 50% membership by the company.
Is that a red flag? The activist wants the committee to be able to hire the banker rather than the board hire the banker. It seems like that gives the committee a little bit too much power, it seems. I don't know. Maybe in some cases, the company has their own banker already, so the board had hired, so there's no point in getting another banker, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen it both ways, but you do see it where they have the right to hire their own. I mean, it's not just bankers and lawyers, it's consultants, it's tax advisors, it's a wide range of advisors, and you don't even see any budget constraints on the committee. So, it does create a separate power center on the board, and that's one of the concerns that companies should have before agreeing to it. I mean, there are a lot of other concerns, but that's one of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, very interesting. Okay, so I have a whole bunch of other topics I wanted to get through, and one of them is private investigators, which I thought was, I just completed an article looking at how companies and activists at times will hire private investigation firms to help them dig up dirt on the other side. And as I kind of looked into this some more, it seems like we're seeing a lot of situations where both sides hire private investigators. It's just not something that either side publicly discloses. So I guess, Keith, I'm curious, you know, would you recommend a company facing activists hire a private eye? And it seems like what I learned when I was doing research on the project is like you could have a private eye do a very kind of a basic vetting, or you could have them do a very in-depth investigation with interviews and things like that. So I don't know, what would you recommend? Obviously it depends on the situation, but just kind of broadly speaking.
Yeah. So first, like, the premise that these are private eyes that, you know, when I think of private eyes, I think of one of these TV show private eyes that's doing stakeouts and all kinds of gumshoe type activities. That's really not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about today is very reputable, sophisticated research firms, professional service firms that have wide-ranging capabilities to do data research, analytics, and put together a profile. And so I think today, given the type of firms that we're talking about, a number of whom, you know, were at the recent Tulane conference, and they're not in the shadows, they're out there publicly, you know, constantly networking. I do think if a company has the budget for it, I think they're a useful group of people to have on the team if the company has the budget.
Mm-hmm. And so this is to like vet like incumbent directors. You would recommend it even in a situation where the company is not currently facing an activist, or is it something you would recommend when, let's say, the activist has a proxy fight trying to replace half the board?
Well, listen, and I know we're going to talk about universal proxy, but I think in this day and age, a board needs to know its members. There's no question a board needs to know its members. And doing vetting that is another level above these D&O questionnaires that are very much compliance driven and not so much designed to get some of the information that's probably relevant, more relevant to a board in assessing whether or not somebody is a good fit or whether or not somebody is vulnerable. It's a good idea to have them vetted. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So yeah, you mentioned universal proxy card, and we've seen a lot of companies adjust their advance notice bylaws to set up basic rules for the universal proxy card. But what we've also seen is a lot of companies using the opportunity to change their advance notice bylaws because of universal proxy card to add a whole bunch of other things, some of which activists are getting very upset about and saying the companies are entrenching themselves. And really, the provision involves, you know, what kind of things does an activist investor have to do when they provide to the company in terms of a questionnaire that the company requires to when they want to nominate directors. And so you had suggested when we spoke about this topic before that an important bylaw is to require a dissident nominee to consent to a background check. Can you explain that? You mean like the dissident director candidate, whether it's an internal person for the activist or external activist back candidate, that they need to consent to a background check? Explain to me what you mean by that.
Yeah. And when we were having that conversation, we were discussing some possible bylaw amendments. And when I think of ones that are helpful that a lot of companies are missing is if you're going to go and you want to vet a director candidate, you want to be able to get the most information you could that's relevant. Okay. I think it's okay to tell them that, hey, this is something we want to do. Are you okay with it? And to get their consent and to be transparent about it. A lot of companies don't have that. But you and I were having that conversation and we were talking about how so many companies seem to get all excited that they now have established that they have the dibs on the white proxy card.
Yes, yes. Yeah,
we'll right.
Get to that too, yeah.
I would never call a company up and say, hey, I was looking at your bylaws and I see some vulnerabilities and I see you don't have dibs on the white proxy card. We need to get going on that. Because I think there's a lot of other low-hanging fruit in the background check is just one of them. But that was my point.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because I often wonder about situations where, you know, sometimes I talk to activists and I say, well, the company wanted to vet your director candidates. How can that hurt? You know, and the activists saying, oh, we don't want our candidates to be vetted. We don't want our nominees to consent to a background check by the company. And I wonder if, you know, they are being cynical, that they're worried that companies maybe are not really looking to interview the activist candidates as part of a legitimate review, and they're not seriously considering adding them to the board, but really setting it up to make it look like they're vetting them. But maybe they're just trying to get some more information that they could use for their defense campaign. So do you agree that activists at times will not agree to let their candidates?
Oh, absolutely.
And
not, absolutely.
And is that why you need this bylaw change, basically, so the companies can at least, you know, interview these candidates?
Well, yeah, there's one bylaw provision that some companies have that I think is helpful. And I understand the concern of why do you really need that? I've had, you know, people indicate that to me, you know, activist side counsel, but having the right to interview a candidate, I think is an appropriate thing to have in the advance notice bylaws. Listen, I mean, this is an important decision as to whether or not to add somebody to the board. And it's not logical that you could really have somebody added to the board without interview. Nobody would assume that they would get hired for a job without going for some type of interview, submitting an application, et cetera. And listen, it's a fair point. Like, hey, am I just going to be ambushed? And this is just going to be a setup. That's a perspective, but that's also a self-fulfilling prophecy. Mm-hmm. If that's the approach you take, because it could be you go and you have a meeting and you're able to convince the incumbent directors on the NomGov committee that you could really add value. And maybe both sides should get in a room and talk about a settlement because maybe this person really does have some attributes that could be helpful.
I wonder if these, like, you never read about these interviews that, I mean, unless it becomes hostile and each side is upset about how the interview went or something, but it sounds like sometimes these interviews of dissident activist candidates ultimately lead to settlement. Is that a fair settlement that add those candidates? Maybe they're outside candidates, for example.
I believe that happens regularly. I think that, if you don't engage. Listen, I've had activists have been saying for years to companies, you know, you and I remember a time when activists called up and the company said, I'm not going to talk to you. I'm not going to talk to you. And now everyone agrees that that's bad advice not to talk to an activist. You have to engage. Mm-hmm. But this is another part of that engagement is having that interview and getting access to independent board members and really being able to have a conversation and tell your story and maybe share some ideas for what the company is doing wrong and what they should be doing right.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. I mean, you can't get a job without having an interview. So, and I know this is kind of a hostile situation, but an interview seems like a very important part of this process. So, okay. So I wanted to shift gears to another one of my favorite activist topics, and that is the Securities Exchange Commission's 13D rules, a topic that you and I have chatted about at various times, I feel like, over the last 10 years. So the SEC recently revise the rules. So this is for you, and an activist has to file a Schedule 13D filing when they cross ownership of 5% of a company's shares and they have some sort of active agenda at the company. Obviously, if it's passive and they're a passive investor, they file a 13G passive, but we're talking about the activist 13D filings. So I guess, Keith, I'm curious, what do you think of the new rules that kind of expedited the disclosure after crossing 5% a little bit? And you had suggested also that activists should provide more information beyond what we typically describe as boilerplate disclosure in the item 4 section of the filing. Item 4 is a section of every 13D filing that I immediately go to when I see a high profile activist, let's say Starboard or Elliott, file a 13D to try to extrapolate what the activist's agenda is And often it's kind of a boilerplate of a whole bunch of different things and doesn't really tell us much. So I guess one, you know, what do you think of the rules? And two, what should be in item four?
Yeah. All right. So you're right. You and I have been talking about 13D reform for, I think, probably over a decade, for a long time. And I will tell you that while I think the accelerated deadline is a good step forward, this latest attempt at 13D reform, it's a huge disappointment. Let's just remember that the way that the SEC, the authorization for the acceleration of these deadlines, which is why when you look at what they did, about the only aspect of this that really constituted rulemaking as opposed to guidance was the accelerated deadlines.
Yeah.
That was given to them in 2010.
Right.
Not Frank. Not Frank. That's why I say, I know
you have the authority to do it. Right.
Yeah. Right. Right. That's 14 years ago, right? Mm. And so 2010, they got the authorization to do that. And they're just finally getting around to it today. And yet all these other things that needed to happen in the reform 13D, we're talking about section 13D. I mean, the SEC is operating pursuant to section 13D, rule 13D. This is a statute that's 60 years old, almost 60 years old, going back to 1968. And yet we've seen very little, almost no movement on reforming the rules and the statute itself in section 13D since 1968. So that's concerning. And think about how different our world is today, because when the Williams Act was enacted in 1968, this was really about creeping tenders and street sweeps and hostels, and it was investor protection that was needed. Today, when we think of 13D, we're more often than not talking about the world of shareholder activism and how 13D is used. And yet, when you look in item four, which is, as you say, it's the go-to place for Schedule 13D, and it lists all the plans and proposals, a litany of things that you need to disclose that the activist or the bidder needs to disclose. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, you don't see the word activism anywhere in there. You don't see, in fact, when you look at all the litany of items in item four, and there's a whole litany of items, and I think of the typical life cycle events in an activism campaign, submission of a notice of nomination, an inspection demand, books and records, all these different things that happen, maybe there's some lawsuits. None of those are directly called for in item four.
Oh, that's interesting. So I guess it sounds like you think maybe the activist should have to file amended 13Ds more frequently whenever there's some sort of development. Like, for example, there was a situation I'm following right now where an activist is seeking books and records at a target company. They, you know, they did have not amended their 13D to update it for that point. But, you know, we see these various different stages of the activist campaign, like you say. When they nominate directors, yeah, I guess they have to file a 13D saying that they're nominating directors.
Correct.
But maybe they don't. It's like one sentence. It should be more detailed, in your view?
Yeah, well, it says the language is, you know, a description of any plans or proposals which the reporting persons may have, which relate or would result in. So paragraph D, any change in the present board of directors or management of the issuer, including any plans or proposals to change the number or term of directors or fill any existing vacancies on the board. It's pretty clear that would encompass nominations. Mm-hmm. And it would pretty clear that it would relate to things that relate to a nomination, such as, I think, an inspection demand. Mm-hmm. But the point, I think it should be item four, the SEC should be amending Schedule 13D, in my view, to add in a more detailed litany of items so that it's clear what needs to be disclosed.
So basically, you feel like activists have very bare bones disclosure, just the minimum amount. And sometimes I find that I'm wondering what the timing is. Like usually when they file the amended 13D that they're nominating directors, you know, I already knew about this because they filed a press release. But other times, the first time you learn about an activist nominating directors is in a 13D or an amended 13D. And it's just right. Like, it's very bare bones. And you'd have no idea what the activist wants to change at the company other than the fact that they want to know, you know, they're nominating two directors. You know, so I'm like running around trying to figure out what is it the activist really wants. They want to see the company sold. Do they want to see a division sold? Do they want operational changes? There's nothing there. It just, we have these two candidates. They don't even describe their bios. Like I call the activists up and say, Can you send me bios for these candidates so I can make sure I don't confuse them with other people that have same names or something? And they push back on me. So it sounds like there should be more detail there.
Yeah. And listen, we talked about this before. Item 4 is juxtaposed with item 7. And item 7 is, you know, copies of documents, exhibits, okay, anything that relates to item 4. And yet it's a rare thing today to see a notice of nomination to be filed as an exhibit to a 13D. You just don't see it. And I think there's an argument that it's called for by item 7, but obviously other people take a different view because you don't see that happening. You know, sometimes you'll see the inspection demand filed, but a lot of times not. And if it's only, it's filed, it's more filed as a rhetorical platform to say, hey, we're conducting this investigation of the company and there's a whole PR aspect to it, but it's not clear why that's not filed. I mean, most importantly, you know, my biggest concern with the 13D reform, even though very little too late, is that there's absolutely no enforcement.
Oh, yeah.
I've been ordering enforcement mechanism built into 13D.
Right.
You know, and over the years, I've written numerous articles on this.
Yeah.
Back when there was, you know, cases coming out of the different federal courts, there is no real practical private enforcement mechanism. The courts are relatively unanimous that there's no monetary damages for violations of 13D. Yeah. And so we're basically dependent on the SEC to decide that this is a case that warrants their attention for enforcement.
Yeah. And you feel like there's a lot of cases where these activists are working as a group, but they don't file a 13D as a group. And that's an area where there should be more enforcement. Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, if you're advising a company, I mean, litigating, bringing a suit under Section 13D on behalf of the company, and the company has a right to do it, and the company could potentially get injunctive relief. It might be limited. You remember that there was some cases about 10 years ago where people brought 13D cases. The injunctive relief was very, very limited. But it's not a great use of companies' resources. Because of the limited remedies available.
Right. It's like a slap on the wrist, basically.
Yeah.
In the end, yeah. Okay, well, we don't have a lot of time. I wanted to get through at least one other topic with you, Keith. Yeah. And this is something that I think you spent a lot of time working on, which is the situation involving retail investors as it pertains to, you know, activist situations or just companies gaining quorum at annual meetings. So let's talk about this for a minute. You've said that retail investors are becoming more and more important in active situations and can be solicited more easily with the explosion of social media and social media chat rooms. And it's true. It seems like retail investors have become more important at small cap companies to achieve quorum for annual meetings. And we saw at Disney, for example, that there was a lot of pressure on both sides to spend the money to solicit retail investors. And so talk to me a little bit about why retail investors are becoming more important at companies, particularly small cap companies, and well, although also like at some big cap companies like at Disney, where there was that proxy fight with Trian and Blackwell's. And so what can you do to kind of get retail investors more interested?
Yeah. So with the growth of retail focused brokerages like Robinhood, right? And that's one of the more well-known one, but there are lots of others out there today. There's been a real broadening of the market for people who invest in stocks and lots of mom and pops and retail investors. And these are not folks that read ISS or Glass Lewis reports and they can't get them anyhow because they don't subscribe to them. And so they're becoming much more important, incredibly important than they were in the past. And what's also been a recent, relatively recent development is you had Ameritrade who stopped doing discretionary voting, broker discretionary voting. I know that's an esoteric topic.
Oh, yeah. No, I know about this. We've talked. Right. Yeah. They can automatically vote the retail investors' shares or other shares.
Right.
And that would have helped get quorum, but also it was kind of unfair in proxy contest situations.
Yeah. In proxy contest, there's generally, there isn't any discretionary voting. But then Ameritrade got acquired by Charles Schwab. And Schwab also takes the same approach that we're not going to vote uninstructed shares, which is, this has been a great thing for the proxy solicitors because it makes them much more important than they had been in the past in terms of like, you know, even an uncontested meeting, you really got to think about having a proxy solicitor involved And so the retail investor is very important, because if you want to get quorum and you can't count on the institutions because you don't have a lot of institutional holders, you really got to go out there and you got to find these folks. And I think you mentioned the Disney situation. This is incredibly, yeah, incredibly instructive. And there's so many lessons that, for people to take away from Disney. And I think it'll take a while before they all get filtered out. But Disney spent, according to their proxy statement, and it was probably more because they said it could be more than what they put in the proxy, they spent $40 million to go out there and solicit. They hired a top shelf proxy solicitor. They indicated that proxy solicitor was going to ramp up and have 250 people involved in the solicitation. Now, listen, spending $40 million, and obviously Disney's a very retail-heavy stock. Mm-hmm. A lot of parents want to buy that for their families. Mm-hmm. When you look at what their total quorum was, it's kind of surprising, because their quorum was 69%. So for $40 million, all they got was the 69%. Listen, I remember a time, wow, when we did proxy fights, and if you didn't get 90%, you felt embarrassed. Mm-hmm. Because we were all making an effort, everyone was paying attention, everyone was going chasing all the shares, and all they got was 69%. And that's, mm-hmm, even with the assistance of Professor Ludwig von Drake, you know, the cartoon that they did. And that just shows the creativity they went to. But I mean, I think anyone who had any connection to Disney got solicited. You had two, yeah, shares, you got a phone call, you got multiple phone calls. If you called back and said, I want to talk to you more, they gave you time. Some people said they got a half hour. I mean, they really wanted to hear what Disney had to say. So imagine if for $40 million, you're only able to get the 68% with everybody paying attention, all the publicity for a small cap company, getting to the 50% quorum, mm-hmm, that a lot of companies need in the state of Delaware. That's a challenge today. Mm-hmm. So companies need to be more thoughtful and kind of take the old playbook and maybe have a new playbook today, which is the 5-6 page fight letter may not be all that helpful. Maybe, mm-hmm, it's just a one pager. Maybe it's a lot more emphasis on electronic.
And electronic, you mean like social media, which we saw a lot of that.
And they did a great job.
Instagram, all these places putting, particularly Disney's side. I'm not sure how successful Trian was or how much they invested in it, but both sides, I think, really tried to get the retail investor. But I feel like the company won if there was a winner in terms of getting the retail investors' support, from what I was reading.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, they really made an all-out effort to touch as many people as they can and to go and find people where they were, not where they wanted them to be, which is sitting and waiting outside their, you know, their mailbox to get a card, because, right, that's just not going to work.
No. Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So bottom line though, soliciting retail investors through social media is, I guess, an important thing to do, particularly at small cap companies worried about getting quorum. Is that fair?
Yeah. But remember, they're not going to vote through social media. No. So it's a great way to contact them, and there are lots of ways to touch them and contact them if you get to understand your shareholder profile. But again, but to get them to vote, that requires multiple mailings. And another sea change we're going to see is, back in the old days, if you had 5 weeks of a solicitation period or 4.5 weeks, you know, you have to leave some time for Broadridge to get things distributed. Mm-hmm. That was enough. You're going to see a lot longer lead times, because you got to do multiple mailings, both hard and electronic, to reach the retail holders if you want to get them to vote. And so I think we're going to start seeing, you know, 6 to 8 week solicitation periods, maybe even at uncontested meetings.
Yeah. There was a very interesting situation where there was a lot of retail investors at an EV company I was following that was struggling. I won't mention it, the name, but they were trying to get investors to support an issuance of new shares, and they had having to postpone the deadline, or change the date of the meeting, or postpone the meeting because they needed to keep soliciting because they didn't have the minimum amount needed. And they did it like 3, 4, 5 times, and they did this big social media push, and ultimately were able to get the vote they needed to be able to do the issuance. But yeah, it's definitely something we're going to see more of in the months to come. So anyways, we're out of time. And this has been Ron Orrell of the Activist Investing Today podcast. And we've been speaking to activist advisor Keith Gottfried. Thanks, Keith, for taking the time.
Thank you, Ron. Really appreciate it.